I want to take a minute to finish up something that we were talking about when the bell got us last week. It's really important. I had mentioned, if you noticed on that outline, number five, the three fields of study that tend to provide for us confirming evidence with regard to the nature of the text of the New Testament. And I, in working this week, through material that I've collected over the years, I ran across an article from 1993 in U.S. News and World Report, which predicted that over the succeeding years from that point, it was very likely that scholars were going to cull out some of the books in the New Testament, and that others would be added. And as far as I can tell, over the 15 to 16 years since then, that hasn't happened. And one of the reasons is because of these three fields that we talked about: archaeology, textual criticism, and etymology. And I wanted to point out to you that there are witnesses and evidences with regard to the text of the New Testament that don't go away. In other words, they're here. And they're known about, and that means that no matter how much somebody wishes that they would go away, they won't. And I want to mention to you in a little more detail the thoughts under number six on that outline. If you'll follow it with me, it'll be a little easier, I think. There are six manuscripts, unsealed. Unsealed means inch high. And it's to describe for us a type of text copied from the in the Greek, where the letters are written in all capitals. They're written all with no space between them, and so forth. And they are older than the cursive style or the smaller style of copies. There are six of these manuscripts called unseals that are from the 300s to the 500s. That would be the 4th through the 6th century. These are regarded as extremely important witnesses to the text of the New Testament for several reasons, and we'll mention some of them in our study today. Let me mention the three that are on the paper, and then I want you to know about three more. We described Codex Alexandrinus, codex meaning the book form, written somewhere around 400 or copied somewhere around 400 A.D. Now, the significance of this, I call your attention to again, is interesting. Constantine legalized Christianity somewhere around just after 320 A.D. Can you imagine why it would be that manuscripts of the entire New Testament or all the Bible, that we can find them back to the 4th century, but before that there are only parts or various books or fragments of the total text that we have? Can you see any way in which what Constantine did might make it more likely that there would be copies like this to be discovered?
We're afraid of getting caught.
Exactly. Before that, these kinds of things would bring persecution on Christians, and your life might be at stake. Now they could be copied and so forth. So we're saying here we have complete copies as far back as complete copies could be made. And that's a very important thought here to say. This Codex Alexandrinus contains all the books of the Old and New Testament, with some pages of the New Testament missing because of decay of the manuscript. And it's in the British Museum, came as a gift to England, to the King of England in 1627. Notice what we're saying here. The King James Version of the Bible came out in 1611. That means that it was done without the evidence of this manuscript of the Bible, for example. Codex Vaticanus from about 350 A.D. It has the Greek text of both the Old and the New Testament down, and give the exact verse, Hebrews 9, verse 14. Not meaning that it ended there, but that the other pages were lost from that. And Vaticanus doesn't mean that this was written by the Catholic Church, or that somehow the text can't be trusted because of that. It means that's where that's the owner of it. It's where the museum that keeps it, so to speak. Codex Sinaiticus from before 350 A.D. Think of that now. Has all the books of the New Testament, most of the Old. It was found in, and actually I printed it wrong on your paper, it should say it was found in 1853. Tischendorf, I think H.L. Tischendorf, sometimes known as Count Tischendorf, was very interested in the research of this kind of thing. He found it at a monastery at Mount Sinai, and it came into the possession of the Russian government in 1859, Tischendorf being that nationality, and then it was bought by the British government in 1933 and is preserved in the British Museum also. There are three more of these. And not to bore you with this, but just so you'll know, there's one called Codex Ephraemi, also from the 400s. And this one is a unique, not unique, but a kind of a manuscript that's kind of my whiteboard. If Tim hadn't cleaned it off, you could imagine this. Been written on, and when it's erased, it doesn't all come off. There is a kind of manuscript called a palimpsest, which I'm not saying that right, but it means that the vellum had something written on it before, and they tried to erase it or to smudge it out, and then that was a very valuable material, and then they wrote the text of the Bible over the top of that. Can you see any difficulty maybe in reading or making it out? It was written over a text written in the 4th century by a Syrian man named Ephraim. That hence the name of it. And it is one of the other interesting things about it, it's bilingual. It has both Greek and the Latin version of the Bible together. They could be compared in that way. I'm getting ahead of myself. This one doesn't have the Greek and Latin. The next one does. Codex. Okay. I can do my best. Ephraemi would be like this. Of course, Codex this way, and the word I was trying to say is the kind of text where it's been erased and then written over again. That's the word. Maybe you can see why I'm having trouble saying it. We don't use it commonly in Arkansas. The next one of these is called Codex Visa. And the reason maybe more clear about the reason I'm doing this, and I think it might be helpful to you. I want you to be prepared. When you have a study Bible or the Bible that you read in your daily reading, and it has a marginal note at the bottom of the page or in the margin which will say these two words or this part of the verse or whatever, is not in some older versions, or you'll find these different codexes will be, one will be referred to as B, another the Hebrew letter Aleph, like that. They have initials so that scholars just identify them that way to save space in writing them. I want you to know what we're talking about here, not to be intimidated by that or to think that the text is in doubt by it. It's trying to make very clear to any Bible reader any place where there's any possible question, and to equip you to do further reading on that if you want to. Beza here is the one that has the Greek and the Latin in it. It was presented to the University of Cambridge in 1851. It has a number of additions that are not in the other manuscripts that I've just described here, and it includes like some of the verses, like we talked last week about Acts 8:37. It shows up in Codex Beza before. This comes to be known as some of the Western readings, so-called. I'll explain that a little bit later. And then the other one is the Washington Codex. This one was purchased for the U.S. by C.L. Freer, F-R-E-E-R, in 1906. It's from the 4th to the 5th century, but it's only of the Gospels. It only has the four Gospels in it. Now, the reason I've mentioned this is these are six of certain kinds of manuscripts, the ones written in capital letters. They're all from the 4th to the 6th century A.D., and that makes them older than the other, the cursive type writings that we have, and it makes them also closer to the time of the originals than any other complete manuscripts that we have. Now look at the stuff that I have at the end of this page, and I want to preface what we're about to study with these three thoughts. This means that the evidence is quite public, and I've said this three times because I believe it's very important. There are no secrets when it comes to the handling of the text of the Bible. And believers in the Bible, when they run across a problem, do not merely burn the evidence and ignore it. Our excuse is not that the text has been corrupted or any of that. Any variations or debates over them, whichever have existed, are out in the open, can be investigated by anybody, whether he's a friend of the Bible and he wants it to be found to be true, or whether he's an enemy of the Bible and wishes that he could throw it away, and there are a lot of them. And you know that if there were a way to prove that the Bible's text has been corrupted and you can't depend on it, there are enough enemies who would have done it. That's what I'm getting at, and that's the reason we're taking the time here with this. F.F. Bruce, who was a scholar who wrote widely about the text of the Bible and really some of the first and most important books on this theme, The Books and the Parchments was his book. He wrote a book that I've cited here, The New Testament Documents. It's a very helpful little book. He said, after all of his research, the variant readings about which any doubt remains. Now, what are variant? Variant readings is where maybe in Codex Alexandrinus, we'll say, there is a phrase that's one way, and then in Vaticanus, the words are reversed, or that type of thing. That's a variant. He says, the variant readings about which any doubt remains among textual critics of the New Testament affect no material question of historical fact or of Christian faith and practice. Why is that important to understand?
Because what we've got, what we believe, hasn't changed.
All right. And if someone says, well, there are these mistakes in the Bible, and nobody really knows what to make of it, you know that that person is either dishonest or uninformed. There's not any matter of faith or practice or historical fact which is in doubt because of any textual question with the New Testament. Then archaeologist Sir Frederick Kenyon, has this statement. The Christian can take the whole Bible in his hand and say without fear or hesitation that he holds in it the true Word of God, handed down from essential law, without essential laws, from generation to generation through the centuries. That's his statement, and I thought it might be helpful for us. It's a good summary of what we're trying to say. And I think maybe a good launching pad into the next section of our study here that we're going to get into. Look at number lesson number 9. Yes, Brother Feeney.
For a long time, the Roman Catholics used to run an ad in the papers and magazines that we owe them for our Bible. And the ironic thing was that the Vatican manuscript had missing books, old books.
Yes. Yeah, as I mentioned, it ended in Hebrews 9:14, so that would be quite a bit. I don't know how that kind of claim could ever be made anyway. I never saw that kind of ad, but that's very misplaced, isn't it? I want to take the time, and I'm going to do a little bit more following the text of an outline than I usually would do in a class here, both for my mind's sake, but also to cover this material. I want for us to do something that I think we seldom do, and I think the thought of this intimidates us because of that. I've mentioned the process of textual criticism a couple of times in our study, and I pointed out that we're not talking about finding fault with the text of the New Testament. We're talking about taking all of the manuscript evidence that we have and comparing it and figuring out where there are any differences, which one heads us in the right direction. So let's think about that for a few minutes here. And I say to start with that my position has been and is that any variation which exists in the different manuscripts that we have, instead of taking away our confidence in the text of the New Testament, actually end up adding to it. And one reason why is the work that we've referred to as textual criticism. And I want you to understand what we mean by that, because sometimes people end up thinking, well, it's going to get where no part of the New Testament can be trusted because we keep taking verses or phrases out. And I think we're misunderstanding something, and I'd like for us to be aware of the idea. Textual criticism is the effort to restore the text of the New Testament, not meaning that the text of the New Testament had been lost, but meaning that wherever any differing readings are found among the manuscript evidence, to try to get back as close as we can to what the original said. And let me just say it this way. It seems to me that those of us who are in pursuit of the restoration of New Testament Christianity would have some sympathy for the value of this kind of work if it's done with respect for the inspiration of the Scriptures. And I don't say that to endorse any mistake or mistreatment of the text, but just to talk about the process. Really, you only had two options if you want to know what the New Testament originally said. One is you select one manuscript and declare it the standard and stay with it. In other words, I've listed six up here, and all of them have some variations in spelling or a word order in insignificant places and so forth. You just have to say, well, I like this one better. It's it. And that would be, I don't think that would be the way that we would handle important matters in any other area of our life. The other would be to compare as many of these witnesses as you can and discover what the original likely was. And you could do that, I think. I frequently in my study run across, I will find, like I'll read this commentary, and this guy will be quoting somebody, and I'll read this commentary, and this guy will be quoting that same fellow, and I will find the two sayings to be worded differently. And I can keep on reading until finally I'll get back to who this guy here got his information from, and I can know where the mistake was made. I'm not a very smart guy, but even I can do that. And it seems like that it'd be easy to see that that could be done in comparing these manuscripts. So the work we're discussing is what has to be done. If you think it's wiser to compare the witnesses to discover the original. And that's textual criticism. And we'll give you a very quick summary here of something I think might be helpful to us. Even though these two men were not the first ones to ever try to handle the text by comparing the various witnesses, and even though the thinking about their work has changed quite a bit since their lives, you couldn't very well talk about textual criticism without mentioning Westcott and Hort. Brooke Foss, Westcott, and John Anthony Hort, I believe are their full names. They worked together over a 30-year period in the mid-1800s to publish a so-called reconstructed Greek text in 1881. And they included in their text notes about the readings that they had settled on, and then a very detailed discussion of the methods that they've used to reach those conclusions. Now, the significance of that is that text, the English Revised Version, came out about that same period of time. Ironically, not based completely on their text, but became very influential. The American Standard Version in 1901 was influenced by the text which these two men ended up producing, although it was not based completely on their text. And if you take, for example, a King James Version and American Standard Version, and you notice places where the American Standard Version will say this verse or whatever was not in some older manuscripts, or this is a more likely reading or something like that. It's not a conspiracy. It's not somebody trying to leave out part of the Bible. It's trying to handle the available evidence and get back to the original as much as possible. Can you, if the King James Version was published in 1611, and if the American Standard Version is published in 1901, it was, from what I wrote up here a while ago, did you notice anything that happened in between?
Manuscripts were found and studied.
Which of the six that I mentioned here?
All six.
All six. Okay. that's the point that we're getting at here. And it doesn't mean that one version had no value or misled people or whatever, and the other was the only reliable one. Both of them have to be dealt with on the basis of the evidence available. Let me tell you a little bit about Westcott and Hort. The first thing is they placed all their effort, all their work, within a very important context. And I've copied this, and I want you to hear what they're saying about the overall reliability of the text. And when we mention textual criticism, it's not that you're lost in a maze and you make anything you want out of the text. Listen to this. The proportion of words, they said, virtually accepted on all hands as raised above doubt is very great, not less on a rough computation than 7/8 of the whole. Now, what are they saying there? Out of all the words that make up the Greek text of the New Testament, there's at least 7/8 of them, which it doesn't make any difference which manuscript copy you're reading. They're all the same. All right, that's important. Next, the remaining 8, therefore, formed in great part by changes of order and other comparative trivialities, constitutes the whole area of criticism. Now, what are they saying in that sentence?
There are only an
8th where there's anything to compare or discuss, and out of that 8, what else did they say there? All right, that the great bulk of them are trivialities of changing of spelling or leaving out of letters or that type of thing, and that constitutes the whole area of criticism. So, this is not criticism which takes a pair of scissors and says, I don't believe in miracles, and I'll cut out this part. I don't believe that anybody would have ever said, unless you believe that I'm He, you'll die in your sins. I'll cut out that verse. And I don't think you need to be baptized, so I'm going to cut off the end of Mark. That's not textual criticism. Textual criticism is, what do we make of the places where there are any variations in spelling or word order? And then they concluded this, and I will read this word for word. They said that the amount of what can in any sense be called substantial variation is but a small fraction of the whole residuary variation and can hardly form, more than 1,000th part of the entire text. Since there's reason to suspect that an exaggerated impression prevails as to the extent of possible textual corruption in the New Testament, we desire to make it clearly understood beforehand how much of the New Testament stands in no need of a textual critic's labors. I thought that was worth copying the whole thing. And these are men, how many years in their lives did I say? 30? All right. To meticulous study of Greek text day after day after day. Well, you kind of can see what we're saying. Now, about Westcott and Hort, what made them controversial and provoked all kinds of thought and discussion and writing back and forth about their work is their explanation of their methods and how they chose a reading when there was a problem. And here are the things. They theorized that there were text types and the way, or families of these various manuscripts. In other words, if you let me look over here. If you take the ancient world at the time, if I could get one here that has more of the New Testament world on it, I could show you what we're saying a little better maybe. I don't see one there. If you were to take the ancient world, the New Testament world, there would be certain centers of places where scholarship and translation occurred. One would be Alexandria in Egypt. So we make that one. Another would be in Asia Minor here. They will call this the Byzantine area, the area of the Byzantine Empire. Another one would be this area, and another one is going to be the Roman world, the so-called Western world at the time. Westcott and Hort theorized that one of the reasons there are variations is because of the geographical places where the copies were made. That if you had a bunch of copies made here, and you had a bunch of copies made here, then what they were copying off of would mean that if they had a mistake or a variation, it would likely get copied or spread in those copies. Now, that doesn't seem so hard to understand unless it comes down to assigning which one of these kinds of manuscripts came from which place. Then that becomes a problem. They theorized also, or they believed, that some manuscripts were automatically better than others. That creates a problem. If you take Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and so forth, and you say, Vaticanus is better. Well, their reasoning was if great care was shown in copying and handwork and so forth, then it was obviously done with great respect for the manuscript, and it would be better than one where there were misspellings and work was sloppy and words were marked out and so on. Now, that was their idea. All right. Third, they thought the quality of the evidence is more significant than the quantity. In other words, that handling these textual questions was not a matter of the democratic process where you lined them all up and gave them equal vote. But instead, you tried to look for which was the better quality of evidence, and the way they determined quality was which is the better manuscript, which came from an area where the known work was typically more accurate, and which one is older. Number four, their view was that it's better to put your trust in fewer but earlier manuscripts. All right, fewer but earlier. Now, what happened? Was that the first bell or second? First? Okay. What happened? I just said that so you'll know I heard one. Okay. What happened in the wake of Westcott and Hort's work was this point number four. Those who disagreed most strongly with their conclusions about some of these readings argued that divine providence would not have allowed what they espoused to take place. And that argument was made by Joseph Scribner, a man named Scribner, I don't know if it was Joseph, and then Bergen, a man named Bergen, both very strong arguments that were made against this process. The only comment that I would make about it is an argument that was made under the suggestion that if what Westcott and Hort were saying was true, then people had been without the Word of God for all these years. But if you notice what these men said themselves, they could not identify any doctrine or practice that depended upon any correction or any effort to get to the original that they were talking about. Number five, notice that many important discoveries of material have come along since Westcott and Hort. Well, I've mentioned several of them today. And I'd say that in general, scholars now believe, and I use the English Standard Version, and I notice many cases where this is true. Scholars now give more weight to internal evidence than they do what they call internal evidence or content. Like, does this fit this writer's habits? Does this fit the theme of this book? That type of thing. They will rely on that a lot more than they do Westcott and Hort's practices. So what I'm getting at is, don't think that when someone mentions textual criticism, they're just talking about what Westcott and Hort did. I've got on number seven a list of things we're not going to have time to cover in our class about the current practices of textual criticism. These were jotted down. I showed you the source where these came from, something Max Patterson actually wrote. And I'd like you to notice carefully several of the statements in here that might explain some things for you, especially F is very important. E is a very important part of this process. K is very important to this, and L is very important to the current thinking along these lines. So please do your own review of those points for next time, and we'll move on with our class so it won't be as much detailed stuff. I hope this is interesting to you. It is to me, and helps to understand what I'm dealing with when I open my Bible and notice the notes at the bottom. So, and I come away with more confidence than ever in the Lord's Word. Monty?
Yeah, in some ways, years ago, when I read the King James Version, it's hard to understand. You know, words, word usage, what it meant. Again, mm-hmm. reading some of the newer versions, red text, like we talked about, this did not appear in all of them. Most ancient of all manuscripts, it kind of shook my faith somewhat in reading that, whether or not I could have confidence in what I was reading. Was it the Word of God or not?
Yeah. I think you're
teaching on it.
Yeah. I think you're not unique in that way, Monty. I think that happens especially to our younger people, too. And that's what we're trying to overcome here. Yeah, yeah. Appreciate your comment.
Well, and also like the Amplified, the ones that actually add like two or three sentences every verse. I mean, to me, that's not unique.
That are more like commentaries, yes.
Too much.
I want to show the difference. We're going to move next to the English Bible. I'm going to talk about the King James, which I admire and respect. No work changed history more than them.
But why did God say twice, woe be to someone who changes that type to what? This was a warning.
All right, it was. We attached that warning to our previous outlines. My point is, we're talking about the original text when we deal with that. Are we talking about the Bible in English that God is saying, don't change this through? Yeah, that'll be a good...
Like what you said before, there is no conspiracy. Maybe yeah. I'm a nut, but there is a conspiracy, and they are trying to change the Bible, and they are cutting out verses and whole sections and whatnot, and this was God's warning.
Okay. What we've got to settle, and we'll try to do this as we study, let's do this out in the open. You say how you feel, and I will too. And I want for us to try to look at the English translations of the Bible. A lot of you had questions you wrote down about that. And we'll try to find out what adds to and what doesn't add to. What gets us to the original and what doesn't get us to the original, which is the real question. If we start with a translation, like I said about these manuscripts, and say, I like that one, so anything that doesn't match that in every letter can't be God's Word, then we'll have a difficulty, because I'll say, I like this one. You'll say, I like that one. And so what we got to get at is, what does it mean to translate it? And what are we translating? What we've been talking about today is what we start with. What do we translate? So we're not even to the English version of it yet. That's a very relevant point that a lot of people have, and one of the reasons why we're doing this class. So we're keeping you over time. Okay, thank you, guys.